Welcome to the Radio Book Club. It is a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm at Maeve Conran, and my co-host, as always, is Arsene Kashkashian, who is the head buyer of the Boulder Bookstore. We have a local author in studio, but this is really a universal topic. It's one of our few non-fiction books, but a really entertaining read. Tell us about our February selection, Arsene.
The book is You Look Like a Thing and I Love You by Janelle Shane. And the first thing that caught my attention was the title. You know, what a kind of crazy title. And it's a book about artificial intelligence. And Janelle does an amazing job, I think, of really breaking down what is artificial intelligence and how it works and all the weirdness about it. And so I thought it'd be a fun discussion. It's something that people seem to be talking about all the time and yet have very little understanding of what it really is. And I would include myself in that group.
Well, it's great to have Janelle Shane join us in the studio. Hello, thanks for coming in.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Well, the title of the book really, I think, explains what we're going to be talking about today. And this is something that came up because you or somebody asked an AI device to come up with some chat-up lines. And this was the chat-up line that it came up with that does sound like the English language, and yet it is not quite what you would imagine somebody would say. And so we're going to get into that and how AI is in many ways there and some ways it's really not quite there where we think it might be in terms of replicating human behaviour. But take us through that, the title of the book and this experiment and the experiments that you seem to like to run on AI.
Yeah, well, the title of the book, it came from one of these experiments that I didn't quite know how it was going to turn out. So what this is I give an algorithm a list of existing chat-up lines, pick-up lines that it has to try to imitate. But it doesn't really have understanding of what any of that is. It doesn't have any background. In this case, it didn't even know anything about English. And so it's just given these lines, and it has to try and figure out how to generate more like this. And it wasn't quite up to the task, as it turns out, which was kind of a good thing, because the original lines were kind of gross and cheesy, just bad. And its lines, like my favorite being, "You look like a thing and I love you," they tended to be kind of off, but actually sort of sweet, direct, endearing in a way, because they had missed all of this wordplay and all of this complexity that were in the human examples.
I think I would have done a little better in college with this line than anything I actually ever said. So there is, it is something sweet and endearing. And but what you said about it didn't even know English when it started. So you,
yeah.
So that was the thing. That was one of the things that kind of surprised me. You're starting with really a blank slate, and you have to give it examples, and it has to start from scratch. Tell us about that process and kind of the basic training of a artificial intelligence and algorithm.
Yeah, so whenever you're training an algorithm like this, something that we're calling artificial intelligence or a machine learning algorithm, you have to give it a goal that it has to try to reach via trial and error. In this case, the goal was try and generate more pickup lines. But you don't tell it rules on, like, here's how you start a sentence, you know, this capital letter at the beginning, period at the end, here are some letter combinations. It has to figure that out by itself by guessing different combinations of letters in different orders of letters and then checking itself against the human examples. And so if it's capable, it will imitate the human examples for better or for worse. So if it's not very capable, though, if there really isn't enough information there, or its virtual brain is not complex enough to really figure out what's going on, it will manage to figure out some of the rules, like it'll learn to spell the word you, or it'll learn to spell the word love, but it won't quite get the deeper levels of meaning of what's going on there.
How many examples did you give it in this experiment? You know, how many pickup lines about?
It was not nearly enough. It was only a couple of hundred, I think. And to do a good job of learning from scratch, I would have needed tens of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
Like the more complex a thing that you're trying to get it to generate, the more examples you need, because the more complexity there really is to learn. So some of the algorithms that I'm working with now that are generating sentences that actually kind of make sense. Like, those were trained on billions of web pages. Like, mm-hmm. it's a whole lot of text that they learn from.
Right. Isn't that one of the problems that you get into is sometimes getting a robust enough data set to truly train an algorithm for what you need it to do? That
yeah.
sometimes it's very difficult. And you talk in the book about, you know, people trying to get big enough data sets or creating the big enough data sets, and sometimes yeah. there's failures in that.
Yeah, because remember, it's trying to learn by examples, trying to learn to copy whatever we gave it. And if there are problems in what we gave it, then it will tend to make mistakes. So one example, a kind of famous example, is a group of researchers at Stanford who are training one of these algorithms to recognize cancer in pictures of skin. And what they didn't realize at first was that in the examples they'd given it of tumors, they had not realized that they'd had rulers in some of the pictures for scale. And the algorithm quickly learned that it was easier to just look for rulers than it was to actually figure out how to detect cancer. So there can be all sorts of things lurking in these data sets.
Yeah, I was truly amazed at all the different places things could go wrong. I mean, it seems, first of all, the way you talk about it, it has to be a narrow problem, which is, mm-hmm. you know, which is why self-driving cars are so difficult. But, you know, as an example of something that's more of a general thing, it has to be something narrow. Then the data set has to be accurate or done right.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to ask it to do the right thing. If you ask it something, it could take a shortcut. It could hack mm-hmm. its simulation. There's so many pitfalls. Do you find when you're researching artificial intelligence that it's a rarity to find something that's actually been done right all the way through and is working as expected?
Yeah, there are often all sorts of little bugs, and sometimes they're major enough that it doesn't work at all. And other times there are more minor things that we may discover later, or that people who build the algorithms may not be looking for carefully enough. So you'll get the algorithms that are, for example, they're making loan decisions, and it isn't until somebody comes back later and audits them and says, wait a second, these decisions are biased. You know, why? We have a problem with this algorithm. And then there's some track back to say, oh, yes, well, it was copying human loan decisions. Those are biased. Like, and so that gets back to the data set. Like, it is copying its data set because it doesn't really know the full context of what we're asking it to do. We mean to be asking it to give us a good recommendation of, like, who should get a loan. But instead, what we've technically asked it to do is copy the humans. And so it learns to predict human decisions. And if those decisions have some problems, then it will figure that that's part of its task, too, is to predict the problem.
Yeah, and it'll find those problems, even if it's been the data has been somewhat scrubbed, right? You might not have race in the data,
yeah.
right? You might not have
so
gender
sneaky.
In the data, but it will figure out the deeper implications. By zip code, it'll start realizing there's patterns in zip codes of who gets loans, right?
Yeah,
which then
exactly.
will show up the biases.
Yeah, so if you have communities, which in America we definitely do, that are segregated by zip code with some degree of predictability, the algorithm will quickly zero in on that and say, well, I have no idea how these humans are making decisions, but I do know that the people from this neighborhood tend to not get loans, or they tend to get, you know, arrested more for things. So we're going to predict accordingly. And it may be that what the algorithms have unknowingly implemented is good old-fashioned human racism. And, you know, they have no way of knowing this. They're just predicting numbers.
Well, I suppose this all goes back to why what you're doing is really important. I mean, we said the title of the book comes from this experiment that you ran on an AI algorithm to mm-hmm. see if they could come up with some pickup lines. I mean, that's humorous. You have lots of other examples, you know, in the book, and you blog about it. Getting it to come up with new ice cream flavors or Halloween costumes. And, you know, it's really lighthearted. And yet, as we're hearing, AI is actually being used in society more and more, these kind of algorithms. And they are in many ways problematic. You talked there about loans and also how it's being used in the medical field and how that has been problematic with the skin cancer, where it's detecting rulers instead of actual tumors. So how pervasive is this type of technology? We've talked about the medical field, maybe mm-hmm. finance. Where are we seeing this play out?
Boy, we're seeing these algorithms all over the place. So now even, you know, most smartphones have some degree of machine learning algorithm, artificial intelligence that's making the pictures look better. So if you have a phone that has something like portrait mode, where it artfully blurs out the background as if you've taken the picture with a really expensive camera, that's actually an algorithm in there that's figuring out where the different objects are and how far away they are. So, you know, from your phone to making, you know, autocorrect suggestions, but then people are encountering them in hiring a lot, resume sorting, video interviews where no human even sees you, like the first round of screening is done by one of these algorithms. So there's all sorts of ways in which people who are not computer scientists are nevertheless coming into contact with these algorithms and having to make decisions about them, whether it's should our company use one of these resume sorting algorithms, or should our community allow facial recognition?
Yeah, so the resume sorting one is another interesting one where, you know, the bias has come out in that. And can you talk about some of the things that have been found and some of the major companies that have tried to use them and how these biases are so persistent? And I think the biases to me seem even more obvious when you see a computer doing it, maybe, than when you see humans doing it. It's like holding a mirror up to ourselves, isn't it?
Yeah, one of the things about computer resume sorting is that you can do a whole bunch of statistical tests. You can say, okay, we've got two resumes are the same and we're just going to change the name, or we're just going to change, you know, this detail or that detail, and you can start to unravel some of these decisions and some of these statistics, and then hopefully try to improve them. There's some potential there for building systems that can edit out some of the biases that we know are present when humans are making decisions about resumes. But what we're seeing right now is, A, it's very tough to do because, as we mentioned, these algorithms are so sneaky and uncovering information that they're not supposed to have access to. And then B, there's most companies don't seem to actually be doing this sort of checking where they say, oh yes, our algorithm will reduce or eliminate bias in hiring. And while technically possible, you know, if they haven't shown the data, we're not actually sure that they have. So one of the companies that did kind of talk to us about their resume sorting algorithm was Amazon, because they had one that they never actually brought into production because they found that it was so tough to get rid of the bias in the resume sorting. So they had trained it on the resumes of people who they'd hired in the past, and from that this algorithm seemed to have learned to avoid the resumes from women, and it would get really sneaky about it. I mean, people don't generally put their genders on their resumes, but it would look for things like women's colleges or phrases like women's soccer team. And so it was figuring out how to replicate this very strong example from the humans of what it thinks you should do with resumes.
Yeah, it would give those negative weights, right? And
yeah.
And then you have to go in and adjust to take out those negative weights. It would be a constant, you know, to really edit those out would be quite a bit of human intervention, which the humans are the ones who started the bias, so they're the ones who have to make the intervention.
I mean, yeah, and there's improvements that can be done. You could go in, for example, and edit the decisions that the original humans had made and said, okay, if this was a fair decision, we would have this percentage of resumes in the keep pile and this percentage of resumes in the not keep pile. And you could kind of do some of what people call debiasing your training data, try to edit some of that bias out. And by doing that, boy, it's really tough to eliminate all of the bias, but it might be possible to build something that's at least better than human decisions. It's just I haven't seen any companies who are doing that now who have proven that they've done that.
And I suppose that begs the question, why are companies using this? Is it because there's a recognition that humans are flawed and so they have these implicit biases, whether it's resumes or whether it's giving out loans, or is this really a time-saving mechanism on the part of corporations who probably don't care that much necessarily about diversity and inclusion?
Yeah, well, both of those are selling points for these kinds of algorithms, for sure. And, you know, you do see some people building or using these algorithms who genuinely do want to try to use this as one way of addressing there are problems with bias, but other people don't care as much.
So, you know, we're talking about these algorithms and they're making potentially huge decisions in people's lives, whether you get a loan or whether you get a job. Mm-hmm. But the algorithm, the base level, I want to get back to this. You said, you know, you have to teach it from scratch usually, mm-hmm. unless you do what you call transfer learning. Right up front in the book, one of the shocking things to me, I'm easily shocked, is AI has the brain power of a worm. Can you explain that? What does that mean?
So this is a rough guess, but I think it's a really useful rough guess for kind of putting into perspective how smart is what we call AI today. Because the AI from science fiction, which I love, but the AI in science fiction tends to be human level or above, like this thing that we call general AI. And what we have today is a lot less complicated. Like, if you're counting raw computing power, my best estimate is we are somewhere around the level of an earthworm, something like that. So we have something what we call narrow artificial intelligence instead. And it can do a good job if you give it a problem that's really well defined and really narrow, like playing chess or something. But there are a lot of aspects of human life, like language, for example, that are not narrow problems, and these tiny little worm brains really miss a lot.
How does this fit into what's called the Turing test, right? We always hear about this. A computer that is going to be able to fool humans into believing it's human in a conversation. And that mm-hmm. seems like it would take a higher level than a worm. I mean, has there been success with that? And how does that fit into this whole conversation?
Yeah, so this famous Turing test, it's held up as a kind of, this is the benchmark for when we'll have computers that are as smart as humans. But we've known for a while that it's not a good benchmark at all, because it is really easy to pass a Turing test if you are good enough at tricking humans. So anytime, for example, that you're talking with something that you're not sure if it's a robot, whether it's customer service chat or whether you've gotten a robocall but you don't know it's a robot call because there are all of these politeness formulas, or you can't just start like asking it random non sequiturs like a computer program would really struggle with.
So I sometimes do, actually.
Yeah, so in general, we don't do this. And so in that way, anytime we're like, is this a computer that we're talking to? Not quite sure. Better be polite in cases of human. Basically, we are reenacting the Turing test, and we are seeing how easy it is for some really simple thing to pass a Turing test mm-hmm. just because of our willingness to play along.
We're going to have everybody now yelling at the robocalls and asking them jokes or various different things to try to fool them. I just want to let people know that you're listening to the Radio Book Club, which is a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. As always, my co-host Arsen Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. And joining us in studio, we have author Janelle Shane. Her latest book is You Look Like a Thing and I Love You, How Artificial Intelligence Works and Why It's Making the World a Weirder Place. Now, Janelle also blogs at AI Weirdness as well, where she explores a lot of these themes. What I got from your book was, I suppose, more of a sense of optimism, or even more of a reckoning that we're not as far as we think we are with AI. I mean, as you said, we could compare it maybe to the brain power of a worm. Yeah. So much of the discussion around AI, and certainly a lot of science fiction that we're seeing coming out, has a much more dystopian type viewpoint, I think, when it comes to AI. The robots are going to take over the world. They're going to become sentient beings. You're saying we're nowhere near, if ever, that right. kind of capacity for AI.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And I know there are some people in the field who have other views, but I agree with the ones who say it won't be in our lifetime, if ever. And the reason I think this is because we have, as humans, have this history of thinking we're very close to having a machine that's as smart as a human and really underestimating the intelligence of people. So, for example, playing chess or playing the game Go, these are both games that we say are, well, if you can play that very well, you're a very smart person. So if a computer can beat a person at this, it must be smarter than the person. But we're beginning to see, like, chess is actually a really narrow problem with well-defined rules, and having a computer brain can work really well on this. But where algorithms can't do nearly as well as a human are things that we don't think of as difficult. Like one example is folding laundry. So not a high status job in our society yet. You know, from the standpoint of training a robot or training a computer to do it, it is much harder than beating a human at chess. It's just, how do you pick up a shirt and fold it? Like, we have not solved that problem yet as science.
And language as well. I mean, we talked about how often now, how we're seeing AI being deployed, whether it's on robocalls or customer service calls, that really has limits. And if you were to in any way push back and maybe say something outside of the parameters of what that AI algorithm has been, I suppose, trained to respond to you with, you know, you could throw a whole spanner in the works, as it were. Humor as well. I mean, all these things that make us so fundamentally human and not a machine. Because one of the other experiments was trying to get an AI algorithm to do a knock-knock joke.
Yes.
It failed miserably.
Yeah, it didn't quite understand the whole concept of a joke. And actually, I've heard people who have small children saying, oh, this is how my five-year-old tells knock-knock jokes, where it's kind of got the formula, but it doesn't quite know what a punchline is. So it's a bunch of random words and they expect you to laugh, and it has the word knock-knock in there somewhere.
At one point, you do talk about what a more general AI could look like in the future. And you wrote, I wrote this quote down, future artificial general intelligence, if they exist, could be more like a swarm of social insects than like humans. So even the way, even if it were to come to exist, it's going to be in a different form probably than what we imagine it as these like robots or androids that are super smart. It could be totally different. It could be thousands of algorithms working together perhaps, or, you know, are you seeing any work towards that? Or
yeah, people are looking at intelligence and complex problem solving from all these different angles. But one of the things we know about today's AI is that it can do really well on these narrow problems. And like I mentioned, and so one way that we could maybe approach something that can tackle a whole bunch of different problems is to subdivide everything and say, okay, well, if we are recognizing a scene, are there any people in it? If there are people in it, let's activate another algorithm that recognizes faces, and then let's activate another algorithm that can, you know, speak to the person. And, you know, there's ways to subdivide and get closer to something that can do a lot more things at once. But yeah, future machine intelligence programs, like, they can get weird. If you look at the forms that problem solving takes in nature, like, you get things like slime molds that can solve mazes, and termites that can do some pretty complicated optimization problems, and they are really simple little organisms. So yeah, there's a lot of different ways that problem solving could go.
Well, it's gonna be more like an ant colony than people.
Could be,
right?
Yeah,
I mean, ant colonies are tremendously complex. And
It seems that in many ways AI is overcomplicating things, that sometimes a human solution is a little bit easier than some very complicated AI algorithm.
Yeah.
That we, you know, we seem to have so much faith in technology that that is the future, that in many ways I think we've almost lost faith in ourselves as humans. I mean, I'm even thinking of the Iowa caucuses that happened recently, that they had this system that worked with humans doing what sounded like complicated math and various different things. But then they threw an app in the mix, and that seemed to mess everything up. And it was like, if you just let the humans do it, we'd probably be better off.
And this is one of the things we tend to see, is you get startups that have really ambitious plans. Okay, we're going to have a robot that's going to learn to navigate the sidewalks, and it's going to bring you your food to your door. And then by the time they get to actually implementing it, they find often that it's a lot cheaper to hire a human to secretly do the job that the robot was supposed to take from the humans. So, you know, we get meal delivery robots robots that people think are autonomous, but when you actually find out how it's done, there's somebody sitting overseas and driving one of these from waypoint to waypoint, like a remote control car.
Are there robots delivering food?
Yeah, there's these things called Kiwi bots that are in Berkeley. And so, I mean, they look really cute. There are these, I don't know, mini fridge type things with giant wheels, and but they only do a small part of the delivery, as it turns out. So you still have to have humans place the orders and load the food into the robots, and then the human drives the robot from, we see a lot of examples of things like this that were supposed to be human solution, or we see a lot of examples of things like this that were supposed to be AI solutions that end up kind of reverting back to humans after we discover it's a lot more complicated than we thought. Like the butler bots, the laundry folding bots is one of them. There's a Japanese startup called Mira Robotics that at first said, we're going to make robotic butler bots that can fold your laundry. And they are now sort of, last I heard, we're pivoting toward, okay, we're going to make remote control robotic butlers that somebody will just drive around your house and do chores.
So I thought, AI turns out to be somewhat lazy, which is a human characteristic.
Yeah.
You talk about that all the time. Like if the instruction is not precise enough, then the AI might just stop. Like if the goal is to, not go outside of this line while it's doing something, it might just stop because then it won't go outside the line.
Yeah.
So that you saw that over and over again, didn't you?
Yeah, it is. Shockingly easy to get an AI that decides the best solutions to do absolutely nothing. You tell it not to lose at Tetris. It says, okay, pause the game forever.
Where do you see all this going? Like, what do you see as the next step? I mean, even in the last 5 years, we've seen incredible advances in AI that we all use. You mentioned earlier our pocket phones, our cell phones, the cameras, some of the apps that are on there, the AI that's being used in there. I've noticed that the predictive text or the autocorrect has really improved almost month by month. All of this technology we're seeing right in front of our eyes. But what are some of the next big boundaries that you see we're going to really leap across in the near future?
Yeah, I think we're going to have a lot more AI tools that people are using in their everyday work. We are seeing, language translators now are using AI tools as a first draft, and in many cases, a very good first draft. People who do audio transcription are using voice recognition tools as, again, a good first draft. And what we're going to see, I think, is more humans that are acting as supervisors and editors of these machine learning tools. So machine learning may end up getting us a lot of the way, but there's all of these small glitches and little mistakes and things that it didn't quite catch where humans have to step in and rescue, because just doing that last little bit, this is self-driving cars is one area that looks like this now, where we've gotten pretty far with the AI driver to where most of the time it is flawless in handling things, but it's that every once in a while something looks weird and it doesn't know what to do and needs human rescue.
What's so interesting about that, though, is it might not really be humanly possible, right? If you're in a car and it only makes one mistake every 50 hours,
yeah,
and then it's going to be a split-second decision that you have to make once in 50 hours, and if you don't make that decision within a second or two, you're going to be killed.
Yeah.
That's not good enough, is it?
No, humans are terrible at those kinds of decisions. I would personally not be alert after that many uneventful driving hours. So,
right. So if you can't get 100%, then you don't really have a self-driving car.
And yeah, that's a bit of a problem. So what we're seeing a lot of now that's on the market is more of assistant type things where the human is driving and the AI is kind of watching over their shoulders and like, did you see that car? Would you consider braking now? And that this sort of AI rescuing the humans from glitches.
So much of this, though, as well, leads us down this path of, I mean, we talked earlier about how this dystopian future where the robots take over isn't really happening anytime soon or ever. But at the same time, we are seeing AI take over many of the tasks. If we're looking for ways to replace humans to do fold shirts or deliver food or drive a car or do translations. We are making a lot of people and their jobs, I suppose, obsolete. And I think to me, that's where a lot of the tension comes from when people hear AI and they hear about all these tasks. In one way, it seems this is great, this new frontier that we're at in terms of technology. But the downside of that is, well, what happens to the people who used to do that?
Well, yeah, and this is one of the things that goes along with any kind of automation, where the automated task may not be done as well as a human. Like, we have now clothes that aren't as nice as if they were hand-sewn for us by tailors, but they're, you know, they're cheaper, so that's what we have now. And we may be seeing that in some domains where we're having a human to do human-level work on this job is a kind of a luxury. So on the flip side, we may have access to a lot more things. Like, now we can get web pages translated for us at a click of a button, whereas before we would have had to find a human who knew that language. But yeah, there's this sort of flip side to the increased access is kind of a lower quality, except for the people who can still pay humans for it.
Well, the book is You Look Like a Thing and I Love You, How Artificial Intelligence Works and Why It's Making the World a Weirder Place. It's by Janelle Shane. If you're not already a subscriber to the Radio Book Club podcast, please do so, because you're going to get some additional content today with the After Hours at the Radio Book Club. Janelle will stick with us. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But as we always do at the end of each podcast, we invite listeners to read along with us. So for our March selection, Arson, what do we have?
We're going to read Turtle Under Ice by Julia Del Rosario. And this is a teen novel. It's told in poetry. And it's about two sisters. Their mothers died. And one of the sisters disappears. And the poems are appearing from both sisters. So it's a dual perspective on it. And I thought it'd be a fun to dive back into teen books. We haven't done that in a little while. And also, we haven't done anything in poetry. So I'm very excited.
Well, people can find more details about that online at news.kgnu.org. And as always, subscribe to the Radio Book Club podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. As always, Arson Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore, my co-host. Thank you.
Thank you, Maeve.